This is a Glassbox Media podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than they're worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
And welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we delve into those difficult moments with some well-known guests. I'm Giles Paley-Phillips, and with me today, as ever, is the incredible Jim Daly.
Still here. You can't get rid of me.
No. I wouldn't want to, mate.
Thanks, man. We've done so many of these now.
Yes.
I feel like we're a proper little team on this now, aren't we? Like, we will not be broken up. No one will come between us. We are a proper little unit on this. Well, it's true. I don't think either of us could do this pod without the other.
No, not at all. No, it's a proper collaboration. And the best collaborations are the ones that work well. And I believe this one does. And you know what? I think also that it's really nice feeling when you meet like-minded people, isn't it? I think, you know,
absolutely.
You can get on with and... And that's the thing. I guess the basis of great collaboration is that mutual.
Well, we did, didn't we? When we met for the first time to talk about this, we'd been chatting on Twitter. We instantly clicked, and we sort of knew, this is gonna, whatever this thing is we're working on, this is gonna work because we get on so well. We're just very similar people, aren't we? I mean, we both support Crystal Palace, which makes us legends before we've even started collaborating,
of course,
obviously.
Yeah, I think a lot of our listeners may disagree with that. But
but also, you're wrong. They're the greatest team in the world. The guests that we get on, and today we've got Maddie Arnholt, who was fantastic, it's the same thing. I think we straight away, we've got a lot of common ground here. We're quite similar, and you know then the conversation is going to be very easy. And we're very lucky that each week we have that guest that we're just...
Yeah, and Maddie's just a brilliant person. I mean, I've got to know Maddie quite well over the last sort of year or so. You know, we've become quite good friends, and, we, you know, often WhatsApping each other, not giving, you know, Maddie's been writing a book, so I've been trying to help her, encourage her with that, and, she's been sort of reaching out for advice and things, and likewise, I'm often asking her for advice on all sorts of things as well. So, yeah, and she's just a brilliant person, and she's obviously moved near me as well. She's just moved to Brighton, so we're going to hopefully hang out a bit more as well. So she's just a great bundle of joy to be around.
Yeah, and a very talented person, you know, very prolific performer, and she talks a lot about her most recent show, which obviously lockdown sort of put the halters on a little bit, as it has with all comedians writing shows and who we're going to be. I mean, she would have been in Edinburgh right now as we're recording this at the start of August. But she talks very openly about that and the inspiration for that show. She's a very easy person to talk to, but the sort of person that when you're talking to her, I felt relaxed and I felt she's very entertaining and just it was a very easy talk. But at the same time, she was talking about quite tough subjects. I think that's a really difficult skill to do that. So I'm actually really keen to see the show she's talking about because she's delving into really quite tough subjects, but to do it in an entertaining way. Believe me, Giles, as someone who's trying to get by in this industry and is not doing as well as I should, it's a very, very difficult skill to talk about difficult subjects and make it funny and make it entertaining. It's not something everyone can do, and clearly Maddie's very good at that.
Yeah, and I think it was interesting what she was saying about like going in, and she'd obviously worked with a director on that particular show, and how they'd sort of said, you know, write it as a TED talk, and then find the funny a bit later on. I suppose, you know, you look for the funny a bit later, but make it, and it goes back to some of our previous pods. You know, I mean, I it still resonates with me that thing that Reg D. Hunter had said to you about. Be interesting first, and then comedy comes as well. Then, you know, I think that's really important. You know, if you're gonna, you know, talk to a lot of people at once and try and resonate with them, make it interesting. And I think that's what, you know, Maddie's done, something that's going to relate to a lot of people.
It's funny how often that comes up on the podcast, actually. That writing process, and it's very true. But it's interesting to hear so many successful people say that as well. So yeah. So anyway, I think we should crack on with Maddie's episode, where we do start.
I've got a tweet.
I was about to say I've got a tweet as well, but speaking of interesting people saying nice things, you do your tweet and I'll see if it's the same one that I've got, and if not, I'll find another one.
Oh, this is like kind of tweet jeopardy or something.
Yeah,
it's like a Russian roulette of tweets.
Now I've got one here from Shazia, and Shazia says, "I'm not a great podcast listener until I got introduced to Blank Pod, real conversations about real topics. I'm now listening to my second cast with Dawn French. Nutella in coffee." Oh, and she's put a little sick emoji. So clearly that hasn't gone down well with Shazia.
I was all up for
that. Yeah, same. You can't please everyone, you know, and that's just, you know, when you're making bold out there decisions like Dawn was with the Nutella and coffee, you're not going to please everyone. But I'm delighted that Shazia is on board with the podcasts.
Yeah, no, we appreciate that. And that's very nice. Nice to have you as another listener.
Shall we get into this week's episode? This is the brilliant Maddie Arnholt talking about life on the South Coast on the Blank Podcast.
How are you finding Brighton? I mean, you've only been there, what, a week or so now?
Yeah, Brighton, when I first came to Brighton, I was like, what have I done? Why have I done this? Because I was in this flat like top floor flat in London, and I've been in London 14 years, and was like, you know, living with a flatmate, but paying, obviously, as everyone is, extortionate amount of money. And I was just like, and some people I think dealt with lockdown when they were like, oh God, I need other people around me all the time. Whereas I was like, I need some bloody space. I need to be by myself. And then our contract was coming up to an end anyway. And I kind of just had a friend of mine was like, why don't you just move down to the sea just for 6 months, just to see like what it's like. And you're doing a book. And you could just use it as, like, we're calling it a 6-month soul staycation. Which is probably the most wanky thing that's ever come out of my mouth. But she was like, do 6 months of meditation therapy, go do some, write a book, be by the sea. And I was like, that sounds nice. So, exactly. So, when I first came, I was like, oh God, this is terrifying. Why have I done this? And I think I said to you, Joe, I was like, oh, I'm trying to be okay with it, but it's really lonely. And actually now after, I mean, it's only been a week, but I'm finally, I think, settling. It takes me a long time to settle.
Yeah. Well, it's a big thing. And you've been in, like you say, you've been in one place for 14 years. That is a long time. It's a big chunk of your life. Yeah. And then moving to somewhere new and having to make new connections and stuff.
Yeah.
It's a big thing. Big thing. Yeah. So I think don't be hard on yourself is what I'm trying to say.
No, and I had like some friends come from London this weekend. And I think actually weirdly what's going to happen is I'm going to have more of a social life being here because
Everyone wants to go to Brighton.
Everyone's like, oh, man. I've had so many messages from like, I've got Yeah. I've got a big family anyway. I've got 46 first cousins. But
Jesus Christ, Maddie. I think we've had this conversation before. That is a lot.
We've got a massive family. So I've had messages from cousins being that I'm like, are we related? Like, yeah. Yeah, we're, I mean, to be honest, anyone could just say that to me and I'd be like, oh, okay. So I think that's going to be a really nice thing where actually, whereas before in London, I'd be like, I've got too much work on, or I might come out for this night and then go back. Now it's like, oh, come down for the weekend. Let's spend some really nice time together and go for walks and go to the beach. So I'm looking forward to that. And then who knows what's going to happen? I'm trying to just do the thing that we're all trying to do, which is just to be a bit present. You know, I really struggle with that. I'm consistently thinking about what the future is and what I need to do and whatever. And I think this is going to be a kind of enforced, like, be in the now period of my life, which is a good thing, which is a great thing.
People that live at the coast seem to be a lot more chilled about life. That I don't live by the coast. So that's a generalisation that I've sort of come to. Is that?
I mean, Josh, you've been here longer.
42 years I've lived by the coast. Yeah, I'm pretty chilled. There's something amazing about the sea. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's like seeing a border to the country almost. Like this is, and then there's this sort of vast expanse. Being out in nature. I mean, I probably spend more time outside, maybe, because I'm, you know, in good and bad weathers. I mean, like the coast is just as amazing when the weather's terrible. Being in the elements. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's a more quieter kind of time of life, I think, down in on the south coast. I mean, Brighton's obviously a bit busier, but where I live, I mean, it's quite a sleepy little town. So people go about their business at a much slower pace.
Yeah, so which I've never really
helps.
I've noticed that. And actually, I think that was one of the main things that really scared me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But then, weirdly, so I had this thing. I don't think you'll listen, so this is fine. I had this thing where... I don't know if I should say this, but I've already started. When I came to Brighton, I'm single. And when I came to Brighton, I was like, let me just get on a dating app and just see the quality of men. As one of my main stipulations to move. And then I matched with this one guy, and he was in Brighton. I was like, great. And then when I went back up to London, he's like, do you want to meet up in London? So I was like, yeah, absolutely. Got on really well, had some dates. And I was like, so how come you're up in London? And he's like, oh, I've just moved here. I was like,
so couldn't wait to get out of Brighton.
But obviously by this point, I'd signed a contract and we were like, so then we had this sort of weird, I think lockdown has just made people, in terms of dating, lockdown has been weird. Like it is such a bad time to date because everyone is terrified. So you either get people being like, no, I don't want to date ever again. No, I don't want to date. I'm absolutely fine. Or you get people like, yeah, so literally let's plan the next years of our lives. What should we do? Wedding dates now? Or like, we I've got friends that are Pinteresting their wedding and they're single.
Wow.
I'm like, what are you? When I say friends, I mean me. But when you... So then I met up with him. We had an amazing time. And then he came down to visit me in Brighton, and he's got the Brighton mentality and I've got the London mentality. And the London mentality is, let's plan. I'm a planner. I love to plan. Like, I love planning. And he doesn't plan. And for me, that's really jarring. And I know that I should get used to that and be like, oh, let's just go with the flow and see what happens. But I guess because my career is so... Like, I'm meant to be in London tomorrow, I think. Well, I am filming an Emily Atack show for ITV. I haven't had call times. I don't know where I'm going. And it's just like this. And so I think because my career is like that all the time, it means that for my social life, I like to be able to go, okay, cool. So in 2 weeks' time, we're going to do this. But then there's all these other bloody dating rules that I didn't even know about, which is like, no, you can't do that when you start dating someone. You have to just, you have to be seen as like busy. And then, and then they need to approach you and suggest a date. And then you're like, maybe. But I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense at all, does it? Because then I will be busy.
I remember when I was single, there were so many rules, so many dating rules about what you can.
Oh, God.
After a date, you shouldn't text again for another 2 days or something because that shows too care. I know.
Oh,
and then if you text too early. And
so tedious.
Actually, with my wife, I actually then texted as soon as I got home. I was like, can I see you tomorrow? And then we just...
And as you should.
Both liked it. So, it was a weird time.
Yeah. I mean, as you should. I mean, there's like a whole nother side of this. Oh my God, then postman's coming down the steps. Let's just see if he's going to ring my doorbell. No, he's not. So there's a whole nother side. there's a whole nother side as well to this, which I'm doing a book about, which is about psychopaths and about narcissistic personality. Yeah.
Yeah, because... Well, you were going to tell me that all about this anyway, so why might as well do it in the public forum.
So my show right before lockdown was called How to Train Your Psychopath, and I've been working on this for years, and I just started doing the work in progresses and stuff, and it was going really well, and we were going to do podcast series and just all sorts of things. We were going to film a panel show, and it's about the empath to psychopath set scale, and about how I fell into the trap of control, the cycle of controlling relationships, basically, and understanding terms like gaslighting and breadcrumbing and love bombing. And
okay,
hoovering.
I know the first one.
Okay, let's take those one at a time. Right, I know what gaslighting is. Breadcrumbing. What's breadcrumbing?
Right, so breadcrumbing is when if you're dating someone and they will consistently fail on their promises, but say things like, oh, we should go on holiday in a couple of weeks. Or, my mum, I've been talking to her about you. She really wants to meet you. We'll do that in like next month or something. Or, my mate's got this wedding at the end of the year. We should go to that.
So
dropping these emotional breadcrumbs so that you follow on this trail thinking it's going to be something, getting completely led on. And then when it does come to a crashing halt, you're like, I'm so confused because I thought we had all this stuff planned. That's breadcrumbing.
Okay.
Love bombing is at the start of a relationship when, and I've had this happen to me before, where on like the first or second date, they'll be like, you are incredible. You are everything I've been looking for. I can see you as my wife. I mean, I had a man buy me a diamond ring after 3 weeks.
Wow.
And at the time, I was so naive on the whole thing. I was like, I think so.
But proposing or just like a gift?
It was like, I'm going to give you this ring for that finger. I'm not saying anything, just going to give you that ring. So then I'm like, and then I wear it on this.
That's really my ring finger.
So are we, well, no, I'm not saying that. So then I'm like,
it's up to you.
But yeah, that's like him reserving you.
Oh, no, exactly. Like, I've just put a reserve tag on. Yeah. It's meant that I have to unpick my whole way of thinking that I've formulated for, you know, however many years of dating that I've had, and realise that, like, God, we are all prone, whether you're married or single or dating, we are all prone to a certain set of behaviours that we've normalised, and some of them are not. But that works for some people. He does this, she does that, he does this, he does whatever you're in. But for me, I will have a thing of like, because I love love. I mean, I love it. And for me, and I say this in the book, it's not Disney, it's destiny. So I've always been like that. I'm not like fairy tale about it. I'm like, no, that's just the way it'll go. Like, there's this program on Netflix right now called Say I Do. Absolutely crying my eyes out, sobbing from start to finish, 45 minutes of crying. I love it, but also it means that I put myself in this like really vulnerable position when I'm dating, where that I will kind of, without even knowing it sometimes, alter my behaviour, as is kind of right. You do alter your behaviour a bit to kind of mirror that other person. But I will just, it's slightly codependent, I guess. I would just give and give and give and then always be on the back foot, you know, always be like trying to catch up. And in a way, it's kind of not fair on the person that you're doing that to, because they then feel like, shit, like this is so much for me to live up to. Well, she's obviously happy doing all this kind of stuff, so I'm just going to let her. But yes, so it's a book, essentially. It's become a book about that. It's about effectively how to end the cycle of controlling relationships, but also to be aware of how many psychopaths and narcissists are in our daily lives right now and how to deal with them, and also how to know where we are on that scale. So yeah, it's been a lot, and I think what I'm finding is, because I've been like researching this and studying this for so long, I can't help but go and like date people and be like, right, so you are about six.
Check, you know,
you're seven, yeah. About seven, okay. All right, well, I would think that's a little narcissistic what you've just done there. But...
add that to my spreadsheet.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's a really strange, it's just a strange time anyway to try and be dating. But when you add that into the mix.
What was the catalyst for this, though, Maddie?
The catalyst was the truth of being in these controlling relationships, and having one in particular, but also just with each one that happened, them being more and more narcissistic and more, and basically being more vitriolic, I'd say is the word, really. And also not me never taking the time between relationships. Like I was in a 4-year relationship, and then I had 3 days break, and then I was in a 4-day relationship, and I had like a week break. Then I was in a 4.5-year relationship, and I was like, stop. And I took like 12 days, and I went into like my next one, and I was like, this is, what am I doing? And then, and I just, so I never took that time. I just was never single, because I was like, yeah, I'm a relationship person, which I think is bullshit anyway, to say that. And dating now is just such a minefield. It's just, you know, it's always been tricky, but in the age of internet dating, my God.
Yeah, I mean, where do you start?
Well, I think for a start, if like the thing at the moment, I think for my main thing at the minute is to, this sounds awful, but I've never done this, and actually it's quite a good thing to do. But as somebody who is single and they're dating, don't just date that one person and like go that per, because I have a thing where I'll put my date up on a pedestal and I'll be like, God, they're incredible. And it's also to do with self-worth as well. If you don't value yourself or think that you're good enough, which we all struggle with, then you are going to attract that person who brings those qualities out in you. You are not, if you don't feel good enough and you don't feel valuable, you are not going to attract a person who makes you feel you are everything and you are whatever. You've got to be that person first, and then you find your match. So I would say that's where you start. Before even going on those dates, you start there.
Yeah, and you need that time on your own to sometimes find, to realize that stuff, don't you? I've got several friends who go from relationship to relationship, and I don't know if it's. I found that with guys as well. Like, there's a lot of guys that find it very difficult. Friends that are guys that find it very difficult to be alone, and have gone from. Yeah, one in particular has been married several times, and. Yeah, he's sort of looking for wife number.
Is he? So what, have you got a number there?
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I get to ask first. Yeah, he's a really lovely guy as well. But yeah, I think it's just that not wanting to be alone thing as well, which is difficult.
It's hard though, isn't it? Because we're fed so many messages about what relationships should be and what they should look like and what you should do in it. In various sort of TV and film and stuff like that. And invariably, every relationship is different from person to person and relationship to relationship, but there isn't really a blueprint for it. But I think there's a lot of expectation on all of us to be a certain way.
There is, but there's this thing that we haven't really, we've sort of just started talking about, which is this the thing that I talk about in the book, which is emotional abuse, and that being a form of domestic abuse. So this coercive control, and when you are in a relationship that is deemed coercive control, that it takes years to unpick this. You know, you don't just, if you're lucky enough to be able to escape that relationship, you don't just come out and have a year or two break and you're like, okay, cool, I feel wicked now. There is so much stuff that's been, because it's manipulation, it's complete, like, basically it's a complete head fuck. So it's literally altered your brain. So, I mean, that is essentially what gaslighting is, you know, yeah. But there's more than gaslighting. But, and what I'm trying to start a conversation of is like understanding those red flags at the beginning and having an awareness at the beginning of what psychopathic traits are, and that a psychopath is not just a serial killer. Like, a psychopath is more likely to be a CEO than a serial killer.
Yeah.
That's the stats.
Yeah.
You know, so...
We've got one in the White House, haven't we?
Yeah, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
But also not just world leaders. Like, they are... There's all sorts of different... Even if they're not psychopaths, they could be covert or, like, all different types of narcissists or vulnerable narcissists or whose main aim is to basically sap the life out of other people to build themselves up. And if you, like me, are an empath and perhaps even codependent, you're much more vulnerable to that. Everyone is vulnerable to a psychopath, but you are much more vulnerable because I know that you did a podcast on this, but the relationship between a psychopath and a codependent is like so darkly symbiotic. They feed off each other. So it's not like an oppressed figure here and then a person who's just like, you know, right at the top here. It doesn't work like that. The two need each other.
Mm.
So
I think when we talked to Professor David Wilson, who deals a lot with psychopaths, I mean, on a daily basis, he said they're very charming psychopaths. You know, they're sometimes, but they're not all like, you know, Hannibal Lecter.
No.
They're often quite, you know, they often have, you know, underlying other relationship issues and stuff, which, you know, obviously you've talked about with the thing. So you've experienced all these things like gaslighting and breadcrumbing and
So for many years, I did. It's a personal story of it, and so we were talking about like dating now, but I think as well on top of that is I didn't trust men for a long time. I don't know that I still do. I don't know that I do 100% now, to be honest. And so not only are you dealing with like the pre-existing difficulties of dating and whatever, but when you load onto that, the coming out of these coercive control relationships, and you're also like hyper aware of like, I do not want to fall back into them. And maybe this person is doing this, or am I reading too much into it? And then you start second guessing yourself and whatever. It's difficult, but I do think it is. I think for me, I had wanted to do this as a show and a whatever for a long time. And then I was like, I don't feel ready. I just don't feel like, I was having massive imposter syndrome. I was like, well, hold on, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a whatever. And in my book, I say, like, I'm not a psychologist. And I'm not claiming to be a psychologist. I'm not a doctor. I'm not claiming to be a doctor. But what I am is someone who's gone through, you know, basically a decade of this. So I will talk from personal experience about I will back it with science, but I will also talk about, like, the way I'm accessing this is about the feelings that you have as someone on the receiving end of that. Because I know that when I had done those shows, men and women, it's a gendered crime, and predominantly it's women who are victims, but there are male victims, of course, will come forward. But I'll have like 6 or 7 people that approach me after shows and be like, yeah, so I've just been through this, or I know someone who's been through this, or I'm in this thing with this person right now and they've just done this. And I am partnered with Women's Aid. So that's been really good, because then I can be like, yeah, just go over there, speak to them. I'm not taking this on. Yeah. I'm so passionate about, you know, spreading a message of education, I guess, on these, because it's not just a bad date and it's not just a bit of a dickhead.
Yeah. Mm.
These are people that take over your life, you know. These are people who put me out of work.
Yeah. I think it's important, actually, you're saying you're claiming not to be a doctor. It's important, actually, that performers like you are actually talking about this, because I think audiences find it easier to relate to a performer who can explain it better, explain it through jokes, explain it through stories. Mm-hmm. And I think that connects better with an audience. So it's actually important that people like you are doing this. I'm writing my first show about being a dad. Not as important. You're talking about actual important issues.
No, it's equally important.
My main theme of my show is being a dad is hard. Your show has got actual meaning behind it. But also... but also, as you were talking, you guys talking earlier about this, I was thinking as well, or realising that it's not just relationships where this kind of thing can happen, or not just sexual relationships. It can be work relationships. You can be working for a boss who's a psychopath, and you're having the same experience, you know, with someone who's got that power over you, that work power. Or it could be, I don't know, somebody you know from your football team or something. These relationships aren't necessarily just dating-wise. They can be everywhere.
Mm. Oh, yeah, they are. And like my book and my show follow this arc of basically going, this is where I was. This is when I realized there was an issue. This is how I started to unpick that issue. And then I go through the whole spectrum of like dating and all of that. And then I talk about, because it's also in family dynamics as well.
Yes.
You can have sociopathic figures within a family dynamic. And I have I've just writing this bit in the book at the moment, which I find really interesting, which is about, I've got a massive bit on codependency. So later, because that affects jobs and everything as well, and codependency being things like fear of being alone, needing constant validation and praise off. And I would argue there are, as performers, we're all a little codependent.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And there's nothing necessarily wrong with it. But I think that when you are doing acts of service, i.e. like cooking, cleaning, domestic, whatever, purely for the fact that you want to do it because you want praise and you need validation and love, and then when you inevitably do not get that, because, you know, not every single person is going to be like, have you feng shui'd the living room, that is incredible, like don't think like that, then you get pissed off, and then this cycle of worthlessness starts. And so when you apply that to a job dynamic and you're a codependent in a job dynamic, and you consistently need like gold stars and lollipops off your boss, and then inevitably you don't get it, then you're like, well, fuck you, I'm not going to do my work then. You know, it can be really damaging. So the whole book, essentially, if I could sum it up, is about awareness.
Yeah.
And it's not victim blaming, it's not psychopath blaming even. It's about awareness.
But that's really hard. You're so right about a family situation. I hadn't thought of that. But if you've grown up in a family situation where there might be someone with sociopathic tendencies, that's very different to, say, walking into a job and you realise after 6 months, oh, shit, my boss is a psychopath. If you've grown up with that, that's your everything. So that's your being. So it's very difficult then to unpick what is your only sort of knowledge of living, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And there's also like there's another layer on top of that, which is you can actually have like there's a belief system which is about genetic or inherited codependency. So even if in your family dynamic often codependency comes from things like drug, being a carer of a drug addict or something like that, of course, but sometimes it can be like if your grandfather was sociopathic or mistreated your grandmother or something, and then, or even like, it could be even further than that, you can inherit codependent traits or the traits, or even narcissistic traits without even realizing it, which is what I think happened to me.
Wow. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Have you looked back through your family history?
Yeah. I mean, I know exactly where it's come from. And I think, again, it's not a finger-pointing thing where I go, this person was narcissistic and this person's codependent. Mm-hmm. That's the way I am. But what I struggled, when I first went to therapy, I didn't want to go to therapy because I was like this broken version of myself. And I didn't want to go to therapy because I was like, this is how, when I think about it now, I'm like, Jesus Christ, buddy. I didn't want to go because I was like, there's people more deserving than me. That's the state of mind I was in. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't deserve therapy, which is obviously bullshit, because there's people who I'm going to be taking up time of people who need it more than me. And also, I had a really nice upbringing. I was really blessed with my childhood. So I don't know why I got myself in this situation. That was my, and that is often the mindset of of people, I'm not going to use the word victim, but the people who've been through coercive control, is that they're like, well, I should have seen it coming, or God, when I look back now, it was just so obvious. But it's not obvious. It's never obvious. So yeah, it's like a complete quagmire to like sift through all of this stuff.
But therapy helped.
Yeah, and I think it's a continuing thing, though. I think for me, like I said, I love a list. God, yes, I love a list. And so, so for me, I went to therapy. I did like 8 weeks of therapy, and I was like, tick, right, I am healed. Okay, onto. but of course,
was it talk therapy?
It was talking therapy, and then I'm actually just about to start another lot of therapy, just being down here. I think, oh, let's just, and that's going to be cognitive behavioural therapy.
Yeah, CBT is great. Yeah,
because I think that we should all, like, you wouldn't walk around with a broken leg, would you? So if you've got, and also you don't, there's this sort of like weird thinking that you're like, well, I'll wait for the trauma to happen, and then when the trauma happens, then I'll get therapy.
Yeah, that's a bollocks way to think, really. I mean, it's, you've got, yeah. If you're in the mindset where you think, like, I want to do it, then you have to go and do it, I think.
And just do it. And even if, like, I always think of it as a way, like, it's just someone who's paid to talk to you. Like, what? It's wicked, mate. You have to listen to me. Good.
Yeah, exactly. Finally. Yeah.
So, yeah, and I'm looking forward to that, of, like, going back in. But I think as somebody who has come out of these kind of very, very toxic relationships, to try and not put yourself back together, because I am together, but it's like, I think I've said this to you, Giles, before, but like, one of the worst phrases in dating or love or relationships or whatever is, he's my better half or she's my better half. I hate that. It is bullshit. Yeah. Because why are you half? You're whole, and you're two wholes that come together. And I think, all of that kind of like thinking of, he completes me, or, you know, whatever. And I know it's just a ton of phrase, but I'm like, damn, sis, you need to be complete. And then, look, and even if, like, I'm 32, and I remember being 30 and being like, oh God, oh my God, I need to get married, I need to have a baby, oh Jesus Christ. And I want that. I want to get married, and I want to have kids at some point. But I mean, listen, one of my aunties, one of the many, she had her first child at 46.
Wow.
All I'm saying is,
that's impressive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, they prefer not to do that. But I would also prefer to make some money and buy a house. You know what I mean? Like.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and find the right person.
Find the right person and not settle. I think there's just such a weird thing, especially in London, of like, it's so fast paced that you sort of, and for me as well, wanting so desperately after I'd come out of this relationship and I'd had the therapy to be like, okay, now I'm ready. Now I've done the work. Now I'm really ready to find someone. But you're not. And every time you go back through, even if you've been dating for like 3 months and then you have that breakup or it just doesn't work, you're like, God, it's just, I can't do this anymore. And of course you can. So it's been such a journey. And I think at the end of my book, I talk about, essentially, I say, like, you could argue that all of the world's problems are down. And like, if this world blows itself up, it will be because of two psychopathic infants having a little tantrum with each other. And so it is, all of our problems really are rooted in psychopathy, in psychopaths. And so the kind of end of my thing is, how do you train your psychopath? You frigging don't. You don't. You leave and you work on yourself.
Okay, do you avoid them? Is that the point?
Avoid obviously sometimes it's not that easy. Sometimes I had people in my show who, I had all sorts of people, but I had this woman who DM'd me on Instagram after, and she said, like, I think I'm in it now, but we've been together for 6 years and I don't think, she says, I think her words were something like, I don't think I'm going to be able to find anyone else, and especially no one like him. And you see, I remember that being said to me, you will never find anyone like me, and me being like, that's the worst thing in the world. But now I'm like, thank God for that. Like, I don't want to ever find anyone like you. And so I really wanted to message her back, and I have to be careful because I wanted to message her back and be like, good. Yeah. Do you honestly want to find someone else like him? Like, but to someone who's in that like interdependent relationship,
yeah,
the thought of being, because it's not just emotional control, it's financial control, it's sexual control. It's all of those, like, it's like you're in their web. That's how I describe it in my book. And you're fucked. Like, your head is fucked. They call it being in a tumble dryer when you argue with these people, because they spin points so quickly and you're exhausted by it. And they remember shit that you are not really sure that happened, but vaguely you remember it. And they are so sure about it. And they spin you and twist you and turn you, so you come out exhausted, eventually probably apologizing for something you have not done. Mm-hmm. And that's how it kind of goes on. I think in my show I describe it as like, it's like being in a relationship with like a knockoff memory foam mattress. They remember everything and you get no sleep.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
But you know, I'm in a really happy place, and I think I'm happy that I can, you know, who knows, Giles, if we can get this book deal off the ground. But
you will, you will.
Yeah. So who knows what's going to happen? But I'm excited for, you know, the potential series and to get the show back up, you know, probably 2021 now.
You're going to take it back up to Edinburgh, are you? Is that the plan?
It's sort of the plan. I mean, I was meant to be at Underbelly, like, right now, actually. And I think that... I mean, I wouldn't say that Edinburgh is my favourite place in the world. Not the location, I mean the Fringe.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been my fifth one-woman show. It just takes everything out of you. And it's just... it's so demanding. Having said that, this was my favourite show that I've ever done. It felt like not necessarily just because it had a message, but because it was me in a show. And I did about 6 years of character comedy, and I did a show on Radio 4 where I was a character, and I filmed loads of stuff where I was a character, but it felt like I was just avoiding what I had to say because I didn't trust my own voice. And I think we all do that.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, it feels like you found your voice with this show, yeah.
Yeah. And I've dealt with quite a lot of dickheads, as you do. I mean, I've dealt with some awful people when I've been doing this show, because you do that, because you are putting yourself out there and calling people's, like, predominantly men's behaviour out. But I do it, obviously, in a jokey way. I even, like, have a jokey thing where I make someone my in-house psychopath and I train him throughout the course of the show. And like, unfortunately, I realised quite quickly that the guy that's heckling you from the back should not be your psychopath, because he probably is on that scale, which is what I did. And he really didn't like it. And, you know, we ended up having like this like argument like, on the stage.
Oh, God. Wow.
Yeah, I had some, I know this was just a point that actually just made me say, this is quite dark, but I had just before, God rest their soul, but just before she, you know, passed, Caroline Flack, there was a point in my show where this guy just kept calling out, yeah, but what about women? What about the women? Like that. And I get it, because I think I say very early on, this is not a man bashing show. You managed to do that for yourselves. You don't need me to do that. Like, I make a joke. And this guy was calling out, what about Caroline Flack? What about Caroline Flack? And I was she was doing some stuff with Women's Aid at the time. And you should never rise to a heckler, right? Ever. You should just let it go. But there was something about this guy that just made me furious. And so I called him out on it, and I was like, what do you mean? Why are you shouting? What do you mean? And he said, oh, well, she did this, and you know, she was beating up her husband, which of course, or her, you know, her partner, which of course none of this was what happened at all. And then it was a few weeks after that she did take her own life, and it just hit, I mean, it hit everyone, but it really, I just thought, my God, you know, this is highlighting right here the, because of course there were other issues as well, but like, I don't really want to go into her story too much because I'm sure we know it, but you know, the kind of centralized belief that of of taking someone else's power, that anyone has the right to do that. Mm. Whether that be someone on in the audience calling me out for something, or, you know, so I think you have to, I have to be very careful with this show that I am not trying to take away, whether it's a psychopath or not, yeah, anyone's power. It's not what I'm doing. I am just laying it out for people to see. And basically I said to myself, what was the show that I wish I'd seen 7 years ago? I wish I'd gone to Edinburgh and seen this, and I would have sat there crying my eyes out going, holy shit. Well, God, that's what this is. And actually, and I can't do that, obviously, but what I can do is I can, and I'm not trying to make myself like the saint of saving relationships, but at least I can try and get through to some people who will. And just every time I spoke about this show, someone would be like, I think I'm in that now. Or, my brother's in that. Or, my sister's in it now. It's awful. We can't get her out. Or, like, my auntie. Or, I haven't spoken to my uncle in 10 years because he's just in this very controlling marriage. It's everywhere.
Well, you will. With a show like that, you will. That you will connect people. But you're right. With subject matter like that, you might get dickheads like that in the audience. And it's almost difficult to stop them. And it's really difficult to understand where they're coming from and why they're reacting like that. But it's on them. It's not on you for putting this message out there and talking about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's on them for their reaction.
Yeah.
So it's really, really difficult. But you'll be helping so many people, surely, and you'll be connecting to so many people that will relate to it.
Yeah, and like you said before, I think the art form of this is comedy, very much comedy. Mm. And I think that's how you get people. Because it's not, there's one bit in my show where I sort of do a bit where I really talk about what it feels like, as Rosie Duffield did, Labour MP in Parliament, with that incredible speech that she did. And there's a sort of similar moment there for me, but it's not a show. I remember this is the first show I did, and I was working with, working with Ben Malaby, who's an incredible BAFTA Award winning, nominated, I think he is, a director. He's incredible. And he said to me, like, the way that you do this show is that you write it like a TED talk first, and then you perform the TED talk. And that was one of the most terrifying things I've ever done, because it was very early on, and people came to my show thinking that, oh, this is going to be a barrel of laughs. And I was like, so here we talk about the psychopath's brain and they have a shrunken amygdala. And what that means is, and then people just being like, what? And then very slowly you start weaving in the jokes, and you find, because I remember looking at that on paper, 36 pages, and being like, that's not funny. And there's no way I can make that funny. And you picked it out. What makes it funny is the anecdote stuff, where some of them are like so close to the bone that you're like, whoa, I mean, that's nuts. But obviously you spin them. Hannah Gadsby and Nanette, similar sort of a vibe there, where, you know, it's just easy anecdote stuff that you don't realise until you finish, that you're like, oh my God.
Audiences love shows like that, where they've realised they've really enjoyed it. And at the end, they're like, oh fuck, I've just had to think about something. And they haven't really had to try, and it's just happened. Those are the best shows, and it sounds like you've got that going on as well.
Yeah, and I think comedy's best when it's challenging people.
Yeah, I agree.
I think, going back to whoever, lots of comedians do the sort of more commercial kind of stuff. But I think, when you're making people actually think about their own lives and the way they interact with each other, then, I think that's much more powerful.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to, I think we are, all the comedians now are kind of, we're sort of like, when do we put on that tour that we were going to do?
Yeah.
And like,
yeah, of course.
Do we do it at the end of this year? And I think most of us are saying 2021. Because it's just too dodgy. Like, it's just too dodgy to just think like, oh yeah, December will be fine. Because I remember when we were approaching the Fringe were like, no, we'll still be on. I'm gonna hold off on that, and then just for now we're doing a podcast series, and so we'll start that at some point. And then obviously the book is going to be pitched in September.
Yeah. So. Sounds really good. It sounds really good, so I'm sure it will.
It will, definitely.
Says the guy with no experience in publishing. Yeah, it'll be fine. Yeah. I'm sure it'll be great. Books are easy.
Yeah, Giles has been like my guru in this, because like, yeah, I remember at the very beginning, so of lockdown, me, I think I'd messaged you, Giles, being like, I might do a book, you know. I might write this, I don't know. I just feel like I should be doing, I'm going to do a book. And Giles being like, yeah, you should do a book, that'd be great. And then what actually happened was I wrote, because I mean, my parents are authors, they were originally children's authors. My dad, Lawrence Anholt, is a, you know, really successful.
Yeah, your
author.
Dad's books are great.
Mm. And he's doing a new crime series at the minute, which is doing really well, just being optioned by World Productions for TV. So we're hoping that will kind of come through. And I was like, okay, I know I don't really want to do a fiction in that way. I think I want to do like a self-development type thing. So then I wrote the framework for this book called A Winner's Guide to Losing, which I think I still will do at some point. But it felt weird to me as to why I would need, it felt like I needed to explain why I needed to write that book in the first place. And the reason why I needed to write that book was, of course, going through coercive control. But I also was like, oh, no, I don't want to do that. Like, I don't want to write that book. And then I pitched it to 5 literary agents and got an offer, and then was doing a podcast with Sam Delaney. And he was like, oh, send me your pitch. I'll send it to some people. And I was kind of like, oh, whatever. This was just a bit, I just was doing it to pass the time. When I say doing it to pass the time, it was 30,000 words and I worked really hard on it. And he pitched it. And then his wife got in touch with me, Anna Pillai. She's from AMP Literary. And she's like a women's non-fiction agency. Yeah. I mean, it couldn't have been more perfect. Former director of Faber, like, and it just all kind of slotted into place. And then I had a Zoom meeting with her, and she said, so what other ideas have you got? And I was like, well, I was doing the show, and then I told her about it, and she was like, yeah, do that one. And I was like, Yeah, but I've just done. Yeah, but there's 30,000 words of this one. Just say,
this one's really good. Let's do this one.
And she was right. Like, she's completely right. And she's been incredible, because I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. I think most of us have no idea anyway. But like, I was sitting there being like, I don't. I mean, at first, I remember thinking, Giles, I messaged you being like, please help me. Do all the words in every chapter need to be the same, like same length. Do all the chapters need to be the same length, Charles? Because I can't do this. I can't work it out. One chapter is like 8 pages and one is 12. Charles is like, just write the book. And I was like, but I can't count. If it's 80,000 words, then how many words is it? I've got my calculator. And he was like, no, just write the book. So that's what I've done. We're only obviously at pitch stages now, but it's
that's
nice.
Sometimes that's the hardest bit, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, you've done amazing. So I know, and it will happen. It will. I'm saying it here now.
Manifesting it.
In September.
Yeah.
The book deal.
But what led you to, like, performing and comedy? Were you always into it as a kid?
Yeah.
You're a bit of a show-off.
Yeah. My nickname was Parrot. I used to parrot people. Okay. I think I lost quite a lot of my friends from my mum and dad, because I was always like, anyone would come in the house
just ripping and I would just
rip the piss out of them. I just mimicked their act. I loved it. Like, I remember, like, we've got American cousins, and then they would come in and I would just love them. I would just do all their voices, and then like the Irish side, as soon as they came, I could do all their voices. That was just my thing. And then I remember I think I was about 11 years old, and I turned on the TV and I saw this program, and I was like, that is what I want to do. And it was Smack the Pony.
Yeah.
And seeing like 3 women up there writing their own stuff, doing their own like clever, but just ridiculous sketches. And I was like, oh, we can do. And it's just so representation in this industry is just so vital, because that for me at 11, I was like, that's it. If I hadn't have seen that, I would think, because I was slightly out of the age of like Victoria Wood, and like that wasn't really my age, but Smack the Pony, I remember being like, wow, because it was all kind of Mr. Bean and like What yeah, else yeah. was there? It was all that kind of Only Fools and Horses a bit, but like all of that sort of, it's very male heavy, male dominated industry. And then seeing this program, I was like, oh, yeah. we can do it. So that was the kind of turning point for me. And then, yeah, I just didn't really, I was like, well, how do you do that? Like, what is the subject that you study to do that? I don't really understand. And obviously I grew up in this like world of imagination. My mum and dad used to test their stories out on us. And, you know, I'm a twin. So my twin and I would be like, you know, like we do all these big, like as kids do, but like all these shows and, you know, just, yeah, we just had an incredible childhood. And then when I just kept going, and this is what I want to do. I want to do some kind of acting. But when I was in sick form, I had quite low self-esteem, and I thought, I don't think I'm good enough to get into one of these drama schools. It seems too much for me. And so I ended up going to Birmingham Uni and hating it, absolutely hating it. And I did about 6 months and dropped out. And then I was like, well, it's just so funny, isn't it? When you're like 17, 18, you think like one slight mistake is like the rest of your life. You know, you're like, well, that's my life, Dan. Well, that's the end of it, really. And then going, well, I might as well. It was my dad. My dad is like a guru. My dad is like the wisest man ever. He is so wise. Like, he's just incredible. And he, you know, we went walking up on these cliffs and he said, like, what is it you want to do? And he talked it through, and my mum kind of, like, is the really, like, sort of logical one. And then we worked out, well, okay, I'll try and get into drama school. And then I did. I got into a couple of drama schools straight away. And I went to ALRA, the Academy of Live and Recorded Arts, which is where Miranda Hart went, Bridget Christie went, Susie Ruffell, who I know you had on, she went. So I know Susie from drama school. And it was great. It was like the best 3 years ever. And then we were sort of like, oh shit, now what? I've done this, now what? How do I do some at the polling? But when I was in my third year, I wrote my first one-woman show. I thought that as a comedian, I didn't realise that you did like 5 minute spots and then 10 minute spots and then 20. I thought you just
straight in
an hour. So I just did an hour. I thought you did an hour, you went to the Canal Cafe, and then you did a month in Edinburgh. That's what I did, because I thought that's what you did.
And then the TV deal would come.
And then the TV comes, and then the Radio 4. Like, whatever. I just thought that's what you did. So I did do that. That's literally what I did. I would be writing a show, doing it, doing The Fringe. And I was doing big venues. I was doing Gilded Balloon. Straight away, I was doing Gilded Balloon. And I'm like queen of hustle. I just don't stop. So any slight little connect I can get, that got me straight into Radio 4. Then I got my Radio 4 show. Then I... off the back of that, I literally met someone, and I was working with Warner, did that. Then I was writing for ITV. So I was doing all of that kind of stuff alongside all of mine. And then I was kind of like, shit, I need this to be financially viable. Don't know how. That's like the struggle, isn't it, that we have, where we're like...
Yeah, constant it is.
I mean, I'm in between. Things are going really well, but... so then anyway, I set up an academy in King's Cross. So I launched my own academy, doing workshops and masterclasses in screenwriting, acting, confidence. And it, just before lockdown, I was actually really, really successful. But I started doing corporate masterclasses, basically, in confidence building. So I did Facebook. I was the speaker for the International Women's Day for The Guardian. I did Albright. So it was just, and it will again, but I just was finding that nice niche where you're like, oh shit, I can charge £600-700 for an hour to do all of this, almost like TED Talk, but funny, with some improv, all this stuff I've trained in for 10 years. And I remember saying it to a friend who's not an actor, and she was like, my God, I can't believe you're charging that much an hour. I'm like, yeah, but that's also 10 years worth of experience. So actually, I know, and also that may be the... only one of only two jobs I get this month, so don't sit there.
I might only work for an hour this month.
So that's in itself, I think this game is very much like, how do I amalgamate as many skills as I've got and put them together? We were talking about this, Giles, weren't we?
Yeah, you have to, absolutely. But you hit on it there with the word hustle, though. Well, hustle is such a good way of describing
whatever it is we all do and trying to get by. There's a real balance between, like, I've got to pay the bills and got to get by, but I also want to do what I want to do. And try and, you can't really have one of each. You've really got to sort of balance it up. But hustle is a good way of... Hustle and persistence, this comes up on the pod a lot, persistence, being persistent, keeping going, keep hustling, it seems to be the common theme for a lot of successful performers.
Yeah.
And you can't just do one thing, can you? That's the thing.
No.
You know, we. I mean, all three of us do... We don't all just do one creative pursuit. No. We do lots of different things, and we have to... Each of those probably work with the others, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And also, keep checking in with yourself, because this is one of those games where you... Where you keep going, and you know, you kind of, you've got to check in with yourself and be like, am I okay? Because no one else, when I say no one else gives a shit, I don't mean that in a negative way, like no one cares about you. But I mean, no one else is going to check in on you the amount that you need to be checked in. Like, several times a day, like, am I okay? And one of the big things that I do is I call out how I literally call out how I am feeling. So, you know, when moving here and like all of that, so I'll be like,
that's
oh god, I'm anxious. Oh,
that's
feeling
great, because you're sort of saying it. We had Fiona Murden on, who's a psychologist, and there is something about when you, Giles might be able to describe better, when you say something out loud, it sort of, it validates it, doesn't it? And but there's a physiological thing in your brain that it actually validates it by saying out loud. So saying your feelings out loud like that, I think really helps you accept it and then deal with it. That's brilliant. I might start doing that. I mean, my wife and...
How are we all feeling right now? I mean,
I'm feeling
relaxed.
I'm feeling relaxed, and I'm shouting. I'm feeling relaxed.
I'm feeling good.
I'm feeling good.
I'm feeling content.
Yes.
I'm feeling hungry. I'm thinking about the gym. Should I go?
I'm
maybe
tired.
It's kind of sunny.
After my run,
maybe I'll sit
which
in the garden.
Wasn't very good.
Now I'm feeling guilty because you've gone for a run and I haven't.
Me too. Oh,
I'm now feeling guilty that you guys are feeling guilty. Go forever.
See, you could just do this like all day. Yeah, but I mean, that's my thing. Cool. And also, so I have like a ritual. So I have morning pages where I write 3 pages and I don't think about it. Free writing in the morning. And then I'll try and meditate if I can. I need to get back into... I hate that. I say in my book that I should is a little bitch. I should is that bitch auntie at the Christmas table who's like, when I was your age, or if I were you, one of the worst phrases ever, if I were you, you're not. So just stop. God, I hate that. So I will meditate, and just there's a meditation called the 6-phase meditation, because for me, my thoughts are so active and so loud that sometimes I just to start my day in the morning, I'm like, I find it very difficult just to sit with my thoughts for 20 minutes. So I will do a meditation called the 6-phase meditation, which I get on an app called Omvana. Obviously everything's on a bloody app these days, but that is a kind of, it's like a, Vishen Lekiani is the guy behind it. And he calls it a meditation hack. And it's basically like he worked in, I think it was computer programming or technology or something. And he was basically like, what's the quickest way that we can visualize, manifest and meditate in the space of 20 minutes? And this is it. And it's like a 6-phase. And I love doing that because you go, it's 20 minutes and I've done it.
Yeah.
It's like I'd rather do a gym class than just go to the gym because I'm like, 45 minutes, done, tick it off. Yeah. Tick it off the list. and then at the end of the day, I do gratitudes. I write down some gratitudes.
That's come up on the podcast before.
Yeah, so important to do that. Mm. We've been doing that around the dinner. Yeah, we do it around the dinner table with the kids.
Nice. That's lovely.
We call it the good, the bad and the gratitude.
Oh, I love that.
So, yeah, so we do a good thing that happened, that's a really bad thing that happened, and then what we're grateful for.
Oh, I love that.
So yeah, and actually it's really, really good because the kids, you know, obviously their responses are normally quite hilarious, but it is good though for us all to do it as a family, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's a lovely thing to do. Yeah, it's so important. I think actually one of the main things that kind of got me out of when I was sort of going through this I called it like that, you know, when you're the phoenix, when you're just but you're not quite risen yet, you know, when you when you've gone through one of these relationships or one of these traumatic times, these quantum moments in your life where you're faced with a decision that you just don't know how, what is going to happen. And actually, ultimately, we need these quantum moments in our lives. And when you rise, you've got that choice. It's one of those like kind of unique times in life where you're like, I've got that choice to rise. And which direction do I now fly in? Mm. And I remember one of the big things that helped me kind of decide which direction to fly in was journaling and to like free write and just to go, I don't know. And you, and like just to a realization really that no one is ever going to be healed. There is no end of healing. You don't like meet the big guy, a big guy at the end of your road, and he's like, you're done. And you're like, yes, wicked. I knew I'd get here. It's a continued thing. You just keep going with it. That's what I'm saying about the therapy. Like, there's this sort of belief. I spoke to a friend yesterday and I said, like, I think I might go back into therapy while I'm here. And she's like, oh my God, why?
Yeah.
What's happened? Oh no, are you okay?
Yeah, it does. It's, oh, are you okay?
You're like, yeah.
If you told me, I would be like checking in on you. Like, I'd be WhatsApping you saying, are you okay today, Maddie? Are you all right?
I'm like, yeah, I'm wicked.
Yeah.
If anything, I'm better than I am. It's clearly, I've got a bit of extra money, haven't I?
Oh, she's doing fine. She can afford CBT. She's doing all right. But yeah, no, but we do go to that, don't we? We do sort of suddenly think, oh, no, there must be something wrong. As opposed to you're doing it for, you know, because you're actually sometimes in a good place, and actually being in a good place, you sometimes it's good to start.
That's true.
To open up more.
I mean, I think as well, I haven't mentioned this yet, but I seem to be doing like a triple pronged attack with How to Train Your Psychopath. I'm actually working with this guy called Joe Roberts, who's a brilliant filmmaker. I did a short called Kelly that was nominated for
fantastic.
Palm Springs.
Thanks, loved it. Yeah. No, it's brilliant.
Thank you.
I'll send you a link, Jim, because it's great.
Cool,
it's
so okay. Good.
Thank you. And we co-wrote that together, and his directing style is just brilliant. Like, he is just so, it's very Mike Lee. It's super understated, which I love, that very subtle. And we've worked together for years, and basically there was like a sort of online Palm Springs festival, and we got some really lovely responses and stuff. Mm. And he was like, yeah, so I'm sort of thinking like we should be working on something. This is kind of the beginning of lockdown. And then I started talking to him about the book of the show. And he was like, great, let's do it as a script. So now we've just finished the pilot of that.
Wow.
Amazing.
Which is good. So that's going to go off. We've just finished second draft of that, and we're just putting together the pitch pack. So that will go out within the next kind of couple of weeks to pitch that for TV. Which is really exciting. And it's actually probably the first thing I've ever co-written where I feel like, God, this is a bloody good dynamic, which I don't find that very often.
Do you not normally do, because I'm a real collaborator. I like collaborating. Do you find collaboration a little bit more difficult?
I find it quite daunting, actually. I think that's, this again links to codependency. I feel like I'm one of those people who just goes, I'll just do it. Don't worry about it. When your mum used to be like, right, can someone do the washing up? And then there would be a beat of like 3 seconds, and she's like, oh, do you know what, I'll just do it. You're like, we haven't even, no one's made that. Yeah. And see, Giles, you'd do that, but I'd go, no, I'm doing it. And then I'd jump up. See, I'm that person. So I think when it comes to collaborating with stuff, I would end up taking the lion's share, and then that person would then feel guilty because they'd be like, well, I'm not doing enough. But actually with Joe, it's just been unreal. It's been like absolutely beautiful. Like, I would write, because it's essentially my story, but he was very good at the beginning at saying, like, you don't need therapy. This is not therapy. This is not the exercise of this. And Ben said this too, like, you do not want this to look like you are venting or this is your version of therapy. Because I know that some comedians are like, ha ha ha, being on stage is therapy. But I think that you've got to have like that personal, that private hat and that professional hat. And if you mix the two, even if you are work, of course, we all work as creators. We work from our lives, but that's got to be your stimulus. And then even like putting a different character name on it helps you to be like, oh, I'm talking about Zoe in this. Zoe's not me. I'm feeding her through me, but she's not me.
You have to find a way to connect it to the audience to make it relatable. And that isn't you just yelling at them. You have to think about them in the process as much as you do yourself.
Which I think is why, at the beginning, hecklers were getting to me because I felt like it was a personal attack on me and my story. Whereas when I began to process this whole idea that actually it's not me, I am, even though I'm not doing character anymore, I'm talking as a character, but it's a heightened version of me. Or in my head, it's this Zoe character who's the protagonist in my in the script. In the book, it's the same thing. I talk personally, but in my mind, I don't. You get it. You need that wall of protection, and that's what that is.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah.
It's quite deep, isn't it?
That's such a beautiful little beat, Charles. It's lovely. Well, the thing is, Maddie, we normally at the end of the podcast ask our guests for their advice on sort of blank moments or sort of tough moments, but in the last 10 minutes, you've actually given doled out so much genuinely useful physical advice that people can do. I feel like I don't need to ask that question. You've done it for us.
I think it's also understand that, like, I could tell you a little quick story, which is in The Fringe. So I went to The Fringe, and I think it was like my second or my third year or something, and I got a call. I'd just been able to afford, well, actually, I was getting sponsored by a company, and I'd got a PR, and it was my first PR, and I was like, my God, this is so exciting. But my PR was, a lot of PRs are, was like really cold, really to the point. I'm very busy, and I don't have time for you. And I'd be like, yes, but I'm paying nothing, you know. And let's say he called me and said, you've got an interview with The Guardian. And I'm like, oh, okay. And this is my first bit of national press. So I was like, oh, that's good. Yeah, it's a collaborative piece. It's they're doing a thing on, I think it's like how to access certain areas of the industry, jobs and whatever. And they want you to talk about how to be a stand-up comedian. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not a stand-up comedian. He's like, what do you mean? And I went, well, I'm a character comedian. I'm not I don't do stand-up. It's different. It was like, it's not, are you a comedian? Yeah, but then they'll call you at 2. Put the phone down. And I was like, oh, shit. Okay, so I thought, okay. And I called my dad as I do in tricky situations. He's like, what are you talking about? Just do the interview. Like, it's The Guardian. It's the loveliest audience. You know. So I did it, and it was a really nice little thing. And it was only about a couple of paragraphs. And then it came out, and I was like, oh, really proud of myself, actually. I'm really proud this like secured this first little bit of national, and I think I talked well in the interview. Just came out really nicely, and then I sent it off to loads of people, and I was just about to go in and do a show, actually. And I did what you should never do ever, which is read comments. And I was like, yeah, but it's The Guardian. Like, they're all going to be like, oh god, she sounds, if at all, if they're going to talk about me at all, they're going to be like, she sounds. So I started scrolling. And one of them, I wish I could just wait. If you give me like literally a few seconds, I just
go
want...
find it.
You're gonna find it.
It.
Okay. Oh, amazing!
We need some sort of little jingle music, over this, like, kind of. you know.
Okay, here it is.
You got it.
Yeah. Okay, so there are some comments. Okay, I'm gonna read them. So I turned it to a lot of people. And I was like, look, I'm so proud of myself. I've got this. Few minutes out. Like, Maddie, you're going to go on in about 10 minutes. Is that all right? Yeah, fine. What are the numbers? Numbers are looking good. It's about 3/4 full. Oh, my God. People must have read this interview. Of course, they didn't read the interview with The Guardian. So I scrolled down. The first one was like this. Would it really have harmed you to speak to a professional stand-up comedian rather than an actress looking for a way in?
Oh, my God.
You would certainly have got more insight into the trials and tribulations of choosing a career in stand-up comedy. This is my favourite one. I am a comedian. The person you interviewed is definitely an actress just filling the void of being unemployed by doing her own comedy show once every few years. This was my third in a row. I have never heard of this girl. And on Facebook, I only have 11 mutual friends with her.
What, like there's some sort of arbitrary number? If we've got 25, though, then she's a comedian.
I usually have about 100 mutual friends with comics on Facebook because it's such a small business. It really gives no insight, etc., etc. Next week we look at how to become a plumber by interviewing someone who works in the catering industry.
Fucking hell.
Blah, blah, blah. So this went on, and I was just about to go on stage, and I was like, oh,
shit.
Oh my God, this was, and I just, I was at, like, literally shaking, going, oh my God, I shouldn't have done it. And, you know, this is imposter syndrome times 5,000. Yeah. And now I've got to do an hour show in front of, like, however many people. And I'm like, and needless to say, the show was awful. I went upstairs. I went to the loft, the like bar at the top of the Gilded Balloon after the show. And I was like, oh my God, this is, I felt like everyone was looking at me being like, God, how embarrassed, like, why have they interviewed her? And I started looking at flights. I was like, I was going to eat, what my plan was to, because I was only a few days, you know, about 10 days into the run or something. And I was like, I'm not going to give the Gilded Balloon a choice. I'm just going to cancel and I'm going to go and I'm going to pack my stuff. I was like, I can't do this anymore. I don't. And I absolutely, like, my, and I know it may, maybe this is like some of your listeners, they'll be like, oh God, look, it's just not that bad. But honestly, it's so heightened in Edinburgh already. And you are so exposed all of the time. That I was like, this was just too much for me. I think now, you know, I would probably not, I don't want to say better at dealing with it because there's no really better way, but I think I would be able to process it now better. And anyway, and I was like looking at flights and I'm going to attempt to do a Scottish accent. And this woman came up to me who was actually Wendy Wason, the brilliant comedian. And she's like, she's like, are you okay? And I was awful. Wait, Scottish? Scottish is one of the ones I can't do. Can I make her Irish? Wait. Wait.
That sounded pretty good.
No, wait. I used to live with a Scottish. Okay. So she's like, Maddie, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, no, I just, and I told her what happened. She's like, she started talking. She was like, yeah, that's fine. I mean, that, like, we've all had those moments. And I was like, no, it's not the same. And then she's like, Maddie, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. And I was like, what? And she's like, we are all fucking winging it. We've not got a fucking clue what we're doing. And I was like, really? She's like, I haven't got a fucking clue. I come over here. And then she calls over this guy. She's like, do you know what you're doing? He's like, what do you mean? In life, do you know what I'm doing? I haven't got a fucking clue. Come over here. He's PR. Hey, do you know what? And it was, and we started calling over. And it was this incredible moment where we had like PRs, actors, some punters who were in there. And we had about 15 people just being like, haven't got a fucking clue. We are all winging it. Like, no one. So this pretense that everyone's got their shit together is just that. It's a pretense. Understand that no one has a fucking clue what they're doing. And then you're all right. Yeah. And then you realise.
It is. I mean, it's something I say to people all the time. I don't know what I'm doing. And if I did know what I was doing, I don't think I'd know what I was doing. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't.
No, but if you did know what you were doing, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing any better.
What you're doing,
you're
yeah.
You're doing what you're doing. That's just,
yeah.
Of course.
It's just you being you. And
I mean, there's that famous bit, isn't there, in the Art of Happiness at the beginning where the guy asks the Dalai Lama about something about, like, oh, this woman, and she's got really unhealthy, you know, she habits and whatever, and how does she get out of them? And she's, you know, whatever. And he just looked at her in that, like, stupid, still, calm way that he does and just started laughing. And he was like, I don't know. I was like, I love that. The Dalai Lama doesn't even know what the fuck he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? If the Dalai Lama doesn't know, then we're going to be all right.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, well, thanks, guys.
Thank you. No. This has been brilliant.
You can cancel that CBT now.
Yeah, wicked. I definitely can.
No, Maddie, it's been an absolute treat to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on Black Podcast. And
thank you.
Yeah, we will catch up in the real world very soon.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thank you so much for having me. Sorry I didn't record the first bit.
That's our fault for not
saying
press
record. That was the best bit as well, but never mind.
It's completely our fault. But yeah, thank you. That's been really fun. Really appreciate talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, Maddie.
Pleasure.
Well, there you go, Maddie Arnholt on the Black Podcast. I'm just going to give listeners a bit of insight into how we do these top and tails. Is one of us, we both stare at each other, waiting for the other person to talk, and then one of us will do a thumbs up to the other person. If we didn't do that, we'd have the Sting play and there'd just be silence for minutes.
Yeah. Well, we've come a new way of to be more efficient. I've got this piece of kit now that we can play the Stings on. And so we record the Stings live.
Yeah.
And then I just press the button, press the trigger, and it plays the Sting. And then one of us comes in and it's like another sort of Russian roulette as to who's going
to. Adds a bit of jeopardy
first.
To it. Adds a bit of live performance to it, which is always nice. But there you go, a little insight to the listeners as to the magic.
Well, and also a bit of winging it, which
yes,
we obviously finished.
Which
the
is so
on.
True, and it's that story about Maddie being in the loft bar, and everyone doing their own experience of winging it is fantastic, and it's very kind of reassuring, I think, because we all feel like that.
Definitely.
But to see that there are even these incredibly successful and famous people feeling the same way in all walks of life, be it they're a performer or a bus driver or whatever. Everyone feels like they're winging it to extents, and I think that can help us all feel a little bit closer to each other and less alone in a way, in whatever we're doing. So that was a really nice anecdote to end the pod on.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah, and thanks, Maddie, for being on. It's a real treat to sit down with you.
Another wonderful guest. How lucky are we to have all these... great people on. We are very lucky. Thank you, Maddie, indeed. And thank you to all our listeners, especially those who tweeted that we mentioned in the first part. Of course, if you're enjoying these pods and you want to tweet us and let us know what your favourite episode was or any takeaway from any of the episodes, you can do. Our Twitter handle is... And we're also on Instagram and Facebook as well, if you prefer those platforms. And our handle, conveniently, is the exact same, Giles.
It is. At
Blank there you go.
Pod.
And also we have an email address. If anyone, please send us an email. We'd love to receive even one. Our email address is...
TheBlankPodcast2018@gmail.com.
Very much dating ourselves with that email address.
Very much. Well, it's quite nice because we think, oh, that's when we started, 2018.
Yeah, almost 2 years ago. I think our first pod was October 2018, I think. So we're coming up to a two-year anniversary.
John Ronson was the first episode.
Good.
Do go back and listen to it. That hasn't
no,
dated.
Well, none of them...
Talking about still very relevant
actually,
things.
Weirdly, his has gone full circle, actually, and has become almost more relevant than when we record, which I think actually says less about the brilliance of John Ronson, as brilliant he is, and more about the downfall of society in the last 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But yes, do go back and listen to our back catalogue. There are over 80 episodes to listen
Please
to.
Please do. And of course, let us know anything you're enjoying from them. If you're not enjoying them, delete your Twitter account and do not contact us. anyway, Giles, have a good week. I look forward to seeing you again next week with another guest. And to our listeners, have a great week. And we'll see you again soon on The Blank Podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is a Blast Box Media Podcast.